Hey, what's going on, Giants and Jets fans? Welcome to the latest episode of our Talk is Cheap Giants and Jets podcast from NJ Advanced Media, the Star Ledger, and NJ.com. It is Thursday morning, February the 22nd, right now. We've not done one of these in a little while here. January 11th looks like was the last time we talked to you guys. And so, obviously, a lot has happened since then with both the Jets and the Giants, and a lot to look forward to as well. With the combine coming up next week and then free agency after that, of course, the combine starting basically next Monday, Tuesday, and then free agency getting going March 11th. But, a lot of agents and execs will be talking at the combine to gauge value for free agency, et cetera, et cetera. A bunch to touch on with the Giants and Jets. And we welcome in, as always, Andy Vasquez, our Jets writer. How you doing, Andy? How you doing?
Hey there, Daryl. How are you?
All right. So I guess we can kind of start with where we jumped off that last time. And so last we talked, Wink Martindale was gone as the Giants defensive coordinator. And so obviously the Jets and Giants both had a little bit of change in their or a lot bit of change in their coaching staffs. We don't need to go through every hire they made. But the big one for the Giants, of course, was defensive coordinator. Took a while, but they didn't get their first choice, Denard Wilson, who wound up going to Tennessee to be the DC, which was the job held by Shane Bowen. So now Bowen comes in to the Giants, doesn't blitz as much as Wink Martindale. No one really does. And let's see if he can make things work with Brian Daboll. But that's the biggest of between the two staffs and all the turnover they had, the DC hire for the Giants, considering this could be a, this will be a hot seat year for Daboll. Definitely the biggest move by far. And they got to make it work. That's the bottom line. We've read a lot since the last time we talked, and we did this a month and 11 days ago, about the volcanic nature of just Brian Daboll's interactions with his staff, the unhappiness and tension in his staff because of the way Daboll acts. And so we'll see if he tones that down this year, and if not, how guys like Bowen and other new hires can handle that. That demeanor and that dynamic, and you'd think he'd back off it at least a little bit because clearly that didn't work great, and they only really kept Mike Kafka because they blocked him from interviewing for Seattle's OC job, and the reality remains Brian Daboll could call the plays this year. So Daboll is in the typical mode of a coach who's going into a hot seat here, making changes in terms of his staff, big time changes, and then of course. Like I would guess, like work deployment changes in terms of who calls the plays. That's a huge one. So what do you make of all that? And I'll let you touch it on the Jets as well in terms of where they are with their staff.
Yeah, I mean it's definitely interesting to see, how these two different coaching staffs, obviously the Giants have had at least some success with Daboll going to the playoffs 2 years ago, and they were the staff, of course, that were we knew was going to be having the shakeups going into this offseason. While the Jets said they're going to stand pat, it turned out they didn't stand pat. They've made a number of moves with a new wide receivers coach. New running backs coach, the guy who was listed as their quarterbacks coach leaving, although I don't think he's going to be replaced because Todd Downing really takes care of that. Ultimately, the Jets there is it's probably a good sign that the Jets are making all these changes, especially on offense because of the issues they had. But watching Daboll from afar, it is interesting to see how these guys have to adjust and deal with the perceptions that come when you have a bad season. And the guys who get it right are the guys who have success in this league. Belichick coming back from his mistakes in Cleveland and building what he built in New England is the best example of that. Not on the same, wavelength with changing teams and all that, but it's the same type of thing that these guys in this era have to do on a much more accelerated basis, because if Daboll, if this blows up in Daboll's face, there's a good chance he won't get another chance. So yeah, it's interesting to see how he adjusts and if it's going to change. I'll be interested to see also if it changes kind of the way Daboll interacts with the media and you guys. If maybe he changes that as well, heading into, what is obviously a critical year for him. So yeah, it's interesting to see how coaches evolve. Obviously, Robert Saleh has undergone an evolution for big. This guy who had an amazingly long honeymoon was really liked by the fan base to where it's not like that at all right now. And many in his fan base consider him to be, a huge liability, and he's under fire. And how is that going to change his persona? And we've already seen kind of some of it, in reports and the way he interacts with us in terms of a different side of him that's not so positive. So is how these guys manage that, we act like it's not a big deal. Because what does it matter what they're saying to us, right? But it actually, it matters because perception does matter in this business, and it's going to be very interesting to see how these guys, make sure that they have the right guys in place for their team and also are on the same page message-wise going into the season, because they both of them have a lot at stake this season, and they have to get it right because there is no, safety net.
They have to get it right. They're both very much on the hot seat. And of course, you've mentioned perception matters, especially with the Jets owner, Woody Johnson, who's particularly sensitive to how the team is portrayed and his, every little needle moving thing is something that registers with him, which for good or worse, which generally I would say not good to kind of be that way as an owner. But yeah, I think you're seeing a lot of the. So this is a lot of parallels here with Dable and Saleh in terms of a lot of their leadership flaws are coming out, like with Dable, of course, just his unhinged behavior. Now, he didn't lose the locker room, but it's pretty clear he lost a good portion of his coaching staff in terms of them, wanting to work for this guy anymore. And also, like with Saleh, just his just almost his paranoia about a lot of these things and focusing on things that don't actually matter. And then of course you have the offensive performance or lack thereof with Dable. It kind of really comes back to him, because he is the guy running the offense, even, regardless of who's calling the plays, it's his offense. And with Saleh, it's the decision to go and hire Nathaniel Hackett, who has done nothing to show he can be competent, and hire him because he's Aaron Rodgers' buddy. And so that's both these coaches are dealing with questions, certainly about their ability to handle an offense and mold an offense for a couple different reasons, because obviously Sal is a defensive-minded coach. And then the questions about their leadership capabilities, and not exactly for the same reason there either with the two coaches, but just what is the confidence level on these guys? I think it's pretty low right now, honestly. You really thought like going into last season, obviously Sal had his flaws. They had Rodgers. I would guess if you ask most Jet fans like mid-August last year, what's your confidence level in Robert Saleh and also in Brian Daboll for Giants fans, they would say like, yeah, sure. Like either give the guy a chance, or I feel optimistic, or like, oh, I really think we got the right one in Brian Daboll. But now it's really swung the other way, I feel like.
Yeah, I will say I've been highly critical of Saleh, but he was already in a tough position because, you're bringing in Aaron Rodgers, and Aaron Rodgers was so disgruntled in Green Bay by the end that it's clear. I understand, like, the Jets had to kind of, for it to work, they have to cater to his needs a bit. Saleh went over the top in catering to his needs, and this is now why he's kind of in a perilous position leadership-wise. When you do that and you make all these moves for one guy, and then the guy gets hurt on the fourth play of the season, like they from there, when you don't adjust, when everything you still do is to cater to the guy who's not playing anymore for that year, it's how do you keep the locker room together? And that's what the Jets have done. Like, basically, like, we're like, okay, well, we'll see you next year. And the players in the locker room know that. The fans know that, and it's frustrating for everybody involved, and it reduces any kind of credibility you have as a leader when you're telling that we're going to do what's for the best of the team in the situation. Like, they didn't do the things that were best for the team last year, and they burned a year of these guys, a lot of these guys' prime, or hurt themselves in the process because all these guys are another year closer to getting paid, so which is going to make it harder to keep them together and build a contender. So I think that's a lot of where Saleh lost it. And then, when a coach is so focused, it was really transparent at a certain point midway through the season that his priority was keeping his job for the next year above all else. Again, players notice that, and you know, it may not be like he lost the whole locker room, but you know, everything being geared towards Rodgers is going to annoy these guys to a certain extent at some point, even if they know that having Rodgers back this year is their best chance at becoming a contender. I think that gives them some freedom in terms of if he stays healthy and it goes well, he can recover from this, Salah, and that's why even as critical as I've been of him, I think it was the right move to bring him back just because of the Jets' very unique situation. But yeah, Salah also needs to realize, I think, and I think this will help him a ton if he can realize it, that the situation he's in, him and both Joe Douglas, they went through so much of this year, like basically acting like how dare you criticize us? And they are in a situation where almost nobody gets a shot in the NFL after being as bad as they were to continue their job. So they should be criticized. They should accept the criticism. They should feel lucky to have their jobs and have this opportunity to do it one more time and act accordingly. Will they? I mean, I think we saw some signs of that from Joe Douglas at the end of the season. It'll be interesting to see what he says next week at the combine. But I think Salah he's always been a guy who kind of, you know, you see him on the sideline in San Francisco, you saw him doing that stuff as a Jet, and you see him get upset sometimes. He's a guy who, you know, runs on emotion, and I think he's mad that you know, the way he's being perceived and how he manages that and his emotions this year. Is going to be key to being successful because you got to make the decision, the right decision, not the decisions because you know you're upset or whatever. Like it's going to be a really interesting balance because I don't think he handled that super great at the end of last year, and he's obviously things have gotten worse for him since then.
You're talking about two first-time head coaches here, of course, when they got the jobs, and Saleh entering year four and Dable entering year three. And so I think that another parallel here is these two guys need to kind of have some, you know, it's a hard job. It's, you know, I get it. So emotional maturity and just emotional adjustments, right? So Dable needs to figure out, like, okay, maybe I can't talk to people on my staff the way I have been, right? And Saleh needs to figure out, okay, maybe I need to turn my focus into taking, you know, not some things not so personally, and tuning out what really should be noise, even it's hard to do. So adjustments, as you mentioned, with Bill Belichick being a great example, and leaders in all sorts of different areas, like in everything in life, you know, adjustment being able to adjust is critical. Like you can't just be stuck in your ways, especially when your ways aren't working. You'd be able to have the ability to reflect on what's working and what's not, and to make the changes accordingly. And the best leaders and the best coaches, whatever, are able to do that. And the guys who can't do it, they don't last. And so these guys need to have a moment or moments of like serious self-reflection. Like, is what I'm doing working? And if not, and certainly it's not in a lot of ways, like, how do I, like, am I willing to change it and go outside my comfort zone a little bit, and change the way I operate? Because if not, you know, you're gone and you don't necessarily get another chance, because you're talking about in Salah, like I, you know, as a defensive minded coach, I guess he'd be, you know, he just turned 45. So, I'm, you know, he's not old. I mean, with Dable, obviously, offensive-minded coach to get another chance. Usually, he's about to turn 49. I don't know. I mean, we'll see if either of these guys ever gets another chance if things don't work out. But the bottom line is their chances are running out with their current teams if they don't find a way to adjust. And you know, you kind of alluded to it, and we can transition a little bit here to the combine. Like you said, it'll be interesting to see what they say. Well, Robert Saleh, as usual, he is not going to the combine. The Jets under him have not recently sent their coaching staff to the combine. They let it be a scouting thing for the scouting side in the front office. From what, you know, I understand, like, Brian Daboll probably will be there, but he is not, he's taking a page out of the, excuse me, out of the Bill Belichick book. And he's not talking at the combine. I can't remember if he did last year or not, but yeah, so there you go. You're talking about the two coaches in the NFL who have had the most, I guess, incendiary things written about them, reported about them over the last month plus since the season ended are just dodging an opportunity to address any of those things at the combine. They will, as they have to talk at the owners' meetings in late March in Orlando. So there's no dodging that. And I'm sure they'll be asked about all this stuff then, and they'll try to turn the focus to, hey, we signed this guy in free agency. But yeah, so much for them standing up. And I guess if they don't have to, why would they answer those questions at the combine? But in terms of the GMs, you'll be at the combine. I'm not going to be there. But Joe Shane, the Giants' Joe Shane, will talk on Tuesday morning at the combine, and Joe Douglas of the Jets will talk Wednesday morning, right?
Wednesday at noon.
Wednesday at noon. So that you'll hear for about 15 minutes. I don't know if either of those will be particularly illuminating, but as usual, at the combine, those things are what they are. But in terms of the Jets checklist for the combine, in terms of, I would guess, let's just say like player, draft, prospect, evaluation, and also like the free agency angle with their own guys and maybe other guys, but more so their own guys. Just give me what you think is Douglas's checklist for his trip to Indy next week.
Well, I think, we all know that free agency kind of really starts next week at the combine, where GMs and agents are in the same place. And while technically you're not supposed to really get the gears turning on that stuff but before the free agency window opens in a couple weeks, but there's a reason that these deals a lot of times are agreed to the moment the window opens, because there's some back channeling going on. So I think that's where this week is the most important for Douglas, because he has to have a good free agency. They can't. So they have the 10th overall pick, and I think they don't pick again until midway through day two. So in terms of talking about, this will be where he starts talking about a potential trade down to give himself maybe, something more like a late first round pick, a second round pick, and that third round pick. That's going to be important. And obviously starting to kick the tires on their most obvious needs, which are wide receiver, offensive line, and backup quarterback. And the free agency, I think, will be, it's ironic, or I don't know if ironic is the right word, but it's interesting because everybody focuses on the prospects at the combine, but it's really about, kind of free agency too. And for the Jets, I feel like they have to add a proven wide receiver in free agency, especially with this wide receiver draft. I mean, it's deep, but like the big time playmakers like Neighbors and Harrison Jr. at the top of the draft, they're not going to be there for the Jets at 10. So they can't go to the draft expecting to get a receiver who's going to be a stud on day one. They have to find that in free agency. And then I think also attack one of their offensive line needs in free agency as well, guard or tackle. I would say, focus on guard because it's cheaper, and then money's a little bit of a problem. And then once you get to the draft, maybe that 10 pick is for a tackle. But those are all the things that they're going to be talking about, evaluating the prospects and what they think are the deeper positions, and as they get ready to set their draft board. But before you can really set your draft board fully, you got to go through free agency, and that's coming up in less than 3 weeks from now, and it'll be 2 weeks once we get to the combine. And I think that's where the Jets have to, really start to solidify their plan for how they're going to tackle this, because this isn't, there is no, waiting now. They have to. Woody Johnson said it at the Super Bowl, 7 wins isn't good enough. It's time to win. He's not going to say straight up they need to make the playoffs, but that's what he means. Like, they need to make the playoffs. They have the talent, and they need to be aggressive. And I expect Joe Douglas to obviously, in the past, he's even said, like, we'll be aggressive, but then he isn't. But, like, kind of has to go all in this year.
Now or
So,
never. Yeah, I mean, what basically issued a playoff mandate. That's the same. I mean, you read, it's not hard to read between the lines there of what he said. And in terms of the draft, we'll do another one of these in about a month. We'll preview the owners' meetings. At that point, free agency will be kind of wrapped up, and we can have a better idea of the team's draft needs. We'll get into some Giants draft stuff in a little bit here. But so in terms of the timeline, of course, next week, the combine, as you mentioned, the effective start of free agency, really for the Giants and free agency. The deadline for the exclusive negotiating window is essentially next week. Then it's March 5th because that's the end of the 2 week franchise tag transition tag window, which applies to Saquon Barkley, Xavier McKinney, who could be transition tagged more likely for McKinney. I don't think either of those guys get tagged. Maybe the transition tag for McKinney, which is I think $2.2 million cheaper than the franchise tag and less binding. But March 5th is the end of the window, and that's really when the exclusive negotiating window closes. I know, the negotiating window opens March 11th and the official signing period March 13th, but it's really a March 5 deadline, and really next week. So I think that it's entirely possible the Giants will lose Barkley and Xavier McKinney, even though McKinney is certainly more worth retaining. With the transition tag, all a team has to do is basically offer more than the tag, and the Giants decide like, no, we don't want to keep him, and you get no compensation. So it's a pretty flimsy way to attempt to keep a guy while, you can gauge his market value. But I think Tyrod Taylor and Adoree Jackson, the Giants' other two most notable in-house free agents, they're probably gone. So that would leave certainly the other cornerback spot is something the Giants have to address in probably free agency. They're not going to draft a cornerback high. They got to go get a playmaker, obviously, in terms of receiver, because it's not like Darren Waller impressed last year as, the number one target in the passing game. I think obviously edge rushers are concerned because of Aziz Ojulari's durability issues, and obviously, as we've mentioned a million times on here, three of the five O-line positions are either are major concerns, right? So who are the guards going to be, and is Evan Neal can he be relied on as a right tackle, or do you slide him inside to guard or whatever, or just not start him? So anyway, that's sort of where like a thumbnail sketch of what they have to do. The Giants at the combine. The biggest one, of course, is Joe Shane talking to Saquon Barkley's representatives and figuring out like, okay, what's the plan here? What's the offer going to be? I think the only way they keep Barkley is, and he's the main guy, so we can focus the most on him here, is if they tag him. And they're not going to tag him for 12-2 or 12-1, I guess, which is a $2 million increase on last year. They're not going to do it. I understand they could create more cap space by restructuring like Dexter Lawrence, Andrew Thomas. So 12 isn't as crippling as of a number as it would be with their quote unquote current cap number, cap space number. But I just don't see it. And it doesn't make a lot of sense. He's entering year 7. He's had durability issues. The Giants are not a win now team. Giving significant money to a guy like a running back like him is something a win now team does. And honestly, like they should be trying to start over with a young quarterback and not paying Barkley. And so if he does, like the whole notion that he would go to, that they would not tag him and then he would go to the quote unquote open market and then he would come back and sign with the Giants, that is not happening. Okay. Like, so there's 31 other teams out there, many of which are in more of a win now position than the Giants. Someone's going to be willing to give him a contract, and go quote unquote all in or more all in than the Giants than the Giants are. Right. It's the odds are just so against the Giants retaining him if they don't tag him. He's going to go maximize the value as he should. And someone's going to exceed what Shane is willing to pay. Right. Because they're in another team's in a different position. Like, would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I just like I think we talked about it last time. It's not a knock on Barkley. It's just where the Giants are and their needs. It doesn't make sense to pay him. And that's tough. And it goes back to the decision that was made in 2018 to draft a running back number two overall. It just when you don't have the pieces around him to contend right away, it makes it hard to justify. I think the Jets, some people criticize them for picking trading up to get Breece Hall, but remember that was their fourth pick of that draft in 2022, and they had actually successfully filled three needs before that because all three of those picks have ended up being good players. So if you're gonna take a running back early, you either have to have all these picks loaded up or have the team around them already to do it. It can't be your first priority in a draft when you're a team where the Giants were at that point. So I mean, we both feel the same way about that and have talked about it before, but just going back to that. And then, I didn't answer your question about the Jets, in-house guys. There's not many, honestly. They don't have a ton of pending free agents who are move the needle guys. That's the two guys that are mostly going to be talked about are Bryce Huff, the edge rusher, the homegrown edge rusher, undrafted free agent, who has become one of the best, third down guys in the league. And has made it clear that he's going to seek his maximum value. And given the Jets' other needs and given their depth at the edge rushing position, I just don't see any way he's back. I mean, if they could somehow, if it was $15 million a year, something around that, and they could get him for that, I think it'll be higher than that. Like maybe there's a chance he comes back, but it just doesn't make sense to pay him when you have to figure out the offensive line. You have to figure out the receiver position. You're going to have to pay for a backup as well. It's really hard to see any way that he ends up being back here, especially when some teams are going to think, well, the Jets have a pass rushing rotation. So, Huff's only playing, I think, less than half of snaps. He's made it clear he wants to play more than that and thinks he can be an every down pass rusher. I'm not really sure he can be. But some other team is going to think he can and pay him accordingly. So it's not going to happen. And then the other guy is Mekhi Becton. The Jets not obviously pick up his fifth year option, so he's hitting free agency. And he's not going to be back. I think it's run its course with him and the coaching staff. It hasn't gone well. I think both are looking for a fresh start. And again, some team will be willing to take the chance, even though Mekhi has not been healthy throughout his entire career. He did make it through this season, missed just one game. I think he took a step in the right direction. I think he can, now that he has a whole year of action under his belt, I think he can potentially. I see a team like I wouldn't gamble big on him because I think he's kind of been exposed for some of his weaknesses. But I think he will be better as the season goes on next year because he won't be playing a full season for the first time in 3 years or 2 years. So I think there is some upside there, and some team will gamble on it, but it's not going to be the Jets because they can't afford to put all their eggs in the Mekhi Becton basket and come up empty. They just can't do it. So there's too much baggage and too much at stake. So yeah, those are the two main guys for the Jets, and I think they'll both be gone.
And yeah, and shoot, I mean, if you talk about the four main guys for the Giants, I think they all could be gone. Barkley, McKinney, Adoree' Jackson, Tyrod Taylor. Certainly, I think McKinney's the most likely to stay. The other guys are, as we noted, expendable for different reasons. In terms of you mentioned touch on afford to, the Giants are 16th in cap space right now, according to Over the Cap. That's based on a $242 million cap. I mean, the cap could be higher, but it's going to affect everybody, so it's all relative. 19 million right now. The Jets actually are at 1.6, the Giants at 19.4, and the Jets are 21st in cap space. The Giants, like I said, 16th. We can mention this here because this is kind of the time of year that what teams do this. Like, what could these teams do to carve out more cap space? From a Giants perspective, I'd mention the restructures potentially. The Andrew Thomas and Dexter Lawrence, maybe Bobby Okereke as well. Those could create a significant amount of cap space. The biggest, the main no-brainer cut is Mark Lewinsky. He's a goner. There's no chance he's back. That would free up about 5.7 in cap space. But the other stuff, I mean, they could get rid of Darius Slayton for 6.2, but he's a pretty decent receiver. His net cap number 7.9. Do you keep him at that? That's debatable. Glowinski, not debatable. He's gone. And those restructures probably fall into that kind of no-brainer mode too. So maybe you do that and you keep Slayton. What can the Jets do to free up some more cap space here? Because they need to be able to at least operate. I know they're not going to necessarily splurge, but what do you see happening in terms of restructures or cuts to get them in better cap health?
Yeah, they can make moves. I mean, like CJ Mosley is set to make, like his cap hit is
21.
21.5, but they can, they can. There's no guaranteed money on that, so I think what's going to happen there is they'll
Pay
extend
cut.
him,
Okay.
yeah, at a pay cut, but giving him some guaranteed money over the next 2 years because he's still playing at a very high level. He's not, the CJ Mosley was the best. They'll save some money there. Other guys, John Franklin Myers, they can figure out how to restructure that. They could extend DJ Reed, who has a $15.6 million cap hit, and spread out some of that to give them some more freedom this year. I mean, they can, there's ways that they can free up space. You know,
What
they're going to
about
cut CJ Uzomah, and that's going to save them,
yeah,
you
five,
know,
three.
6 million. But yeah, for five, yeah.
Looking
I,
at
anyway, there's ways for them to
about
do it.
Tomlinson. Will they cut Laken Tomlinson or
Well, it's a tough one because they, Joe Douglas made some decisions last year in terms of restructuring that makes it tough. Like when they cut CJ Uzomah, it's going to come with a $5.3 million. I'm sorry, I was looking at the dead money. It's going to come with a $5.9 million dead money cap hit, and same with Laken Tomlinson. They cut him; it's a $10 million cap hit with an $8 million savings. There's $10.7 million cap hit with an $8.1 million savings. So he's they've they're already carrying a lot of dead money into until next year, 18 million right now, 18.3 million as it stands because of Carl Lawson, 6.3 there, Dwayne Brown, 4.7 million there. Jordan Whitehead, whose contract voided the other day, 3.3 million. Two million more on Mecole Hardman. So yeah, there's a lot of dead money. There's gonna be a lot more dead money, and it makes things a lot harder. But they can, you know, free up enough cap space to make, you know, more than one major signing, but it's gonna be at the expense of next year, and it's gonna be tightening this window even further. So, because next year is when Garrett Wilson, Sauce Gardner, and Breece Hall are all eligible for extensions. We're already at that point. So,
good point. Yeah.
it's going to be it's even more why they have to show something this year, because next year is kind of going to be the last year that you can expect this team as it's currently constituted to go out there. I mean, I think if they're a contender, you can make an argument for pushing even an extension for Sauce Gardner back after next year. But if they're not if they're not on the doorstep, they're going to have to pay probably him and at least Garrett Wilson. So, it's, yeah, they're in a weird spot because they have to find a way to do it now. And it's possible, but it's not going to be easy. And it's because part of the reason was because they were so geared on last year going all in for it. And they kind of took that, you know, very win now approach for the first time, and but without going all the way in. And now they're kind of in this in-between spot where it's tough. It's going to be tough for Joe Douglas to manage his offseason and get it right. And he has to, as we've said multiple times before.
And we'll finish up here by touching on the draft a little bit. As I mentioned, we'll do another one of these in about a month to preview the owners meetings and really more so wrap up free agency. But at that point, we'll have a better idea of where teams stand in terms of their needs, and not just the Jets and Giants, but of course, you know, what other teams do at quarterback will affect the Giants. And so the combine, of course, as we mentioned, is a lot about free agency, but teams are there to assess draft prospects too. And the Giants will be looking at all the quarterbacks as they should be because we know everything. Just Daniel Jones and the whole thing. Jet, as they say, like gestures broadly. Daniel Jones gestures broadly. You know, to use the meme, as they say, so whatever that would be called. Clever turn of phrase, but yeah. So Daniel Jeremiah did a mock draft a couple of days ago. He's pretty good. You know, he's one of the more like sane draft analysts. He's really smart and sharp, and so I think we could just quickly review that in terms of like what might happen at the top of the draft. And even though the Jets are at 10th, they're right there at the top of the draft because and the Giants being six, of course. So like what could happen in terms of the draft unfolding? Obviously free agency, as we said, will affect this. You know, we're still more than 2 months from the draft, but because the combine is a draft event in a significant way, it's worth touching a little. So Jeremiah has the Bears taking Caleb Williams, and then the Commanders taking Drake May. No surprises there. He has the Patriots then at number three, and in this scenario, they go a veteran quarterback route. That means Marvin Harrison to the Patriots, when he'd be clearly the best overall prospect there available. So that means they pass on Jaden Daniels, which bodes really well for the Giants. Like, I think if you see a situation where the Patriots take or sign a quarterback, I mean, Joe Shane will be thrilled because that frees up a quarterback to fall to him, because it looks like Arizona at four will not take a quarterback. And in this mock draft, that's Malik Nabers, the other LSU receiver. Then, of course, at five, there's no chance the Chargers take a quarterback and they go with Joe Alt, the Notre Dame offensive tackle, and that means Jaden Daniels in this mock from Daniel Jeremiah goes to the Giants at six. I think that's a no-brainer pick if he's there. If he's not, like if quarterbacks go 1, 2, 3, which is possible, then the Giants could be looking at a situation where they could have their pick of Odunze or Nabers, because you go quarterback, quarterback, quarterback. The Cardinals take probably Harrison. Then the Chargers would take either Ault or Nabers or Odunze, and that would give Rome Odunze, the Washington receiver. That would give the Giants the Odunze, Nabers, other guy there at a six. Or you know, look, they could, if the Chargers take Ault, that has Odunze and Nabers still on the board at six for the Giants. So that's a lot, I know. But that this mock draft is like the ideal scenario for Joe Shane. Like the biggest problem with drafting six and having one too much down the stretch in these meaningless games with Tommy DeVito is that they box themselves out of the ability to definitely be able to get a quarterback. But the Patriots deciding to, in this scenario, go the veteran quarterback route. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. That would bode really well for the Giants. Now, like, what would they do at six if quarterbacks go 1, 2, 3? I don't think they'd reach for one there. You could still get a really good receiver and then try to get a quarterback with one of those 2 second-round picks, or trade up into the bottom of round one. But moving on to the Jets. So moving down this list at seven, Tennessee takes the Penn State offensive tackle Fashanu, and then at eight, the Falcons.
Fashanu, yeah.
Fashanu, yeah, at eight, which is a guy that I'm sure the Jets would be interested in, as with Joe Ault, but I don't think Joe Ault gets to 10. Eight, the Falcons go J.J. McCarthy. That's high for him, the Michigan quarterback, which I guess by that logic, maybe Daniel Jeremiah thinks that if the Giants aren't able to get the top three quarterbacks, they could take McCarthy at six. I'd be interested to hear his take on that. Then Odunze at nine, to the Bears. Then another guy who's been widely mocked to the Jets, projected to the Jets. At 10, the Oregon State offensive tackle. Do you know how to pronounce this guy's first name? The last name is Fuaga, clearly. Talise Fuaga? Is that right?
Police, yep.
Talise Fuaga from Oregon State. So, yeah, what would you make of that? I kind of went on about what the Giants, yeah, with no brainer. If they need a quarterback, you move on from Daniel Jones after next year. You say goodbye. But what about the Jets there in terms of who they would prefer? Probably an offensive tackle, right? And like, which that's probably the right pecking order. All the Penn State kid and then the Oregon State kid, right?
Yeah, I think this would be an ideal kind of way for things to work out for the Jets as well, as to have. You know, if the top receivers aren't going to be there, and it's starting to look more and more like those guys are going to definitely be off the board before the Jets pick, and then several other quarterbacks are taken, three or maybe even four before then, they're going to have a tackle there who can help them immediately at number 10. And that's what they need, is an offensive lineman that can help them immediately. I mean, it just seems like the odds are that it could shake out that way for them. And they just need one of those top guys, you know, one of those guys like Fashanu or Fuaga. I can say his first name, I can say his last name. I'll learn. But you know, one of those guys to be available.
Penn
And
State,
then that, go ahead.
the Oregon State kid, Talise Fuaga, that's not a part. When the Penn State kid is
Fuaga, yeah, sorry.
Olumiyi, why? That's a tough one.
I can't say his first name. I'm not going to try. Although, yeah, I'm not going to. But yeah, that's where I think, you know, that's why I think they need to kind of be aggressive in free agency and filling their needs, and then it being available. And then if their guys aren't available there, they need to be ready to trade down, which they clearly weren't last year with Will McDonald when they took him at 15. Like, you can't let that happen again. You have to have a way to get out, and it needs to be kind of figured out, I guess, before the draft. I know that's easier said than done, but that's your job. You can't not get a guy at a position of need and make that pick. You have to get out of it if you don't, because they need guys that can help them now. It's not a question. So yeah, that's this would work out well for the Jets. I think there's a good chance that, you know, receiver, we're seeing these guys make such a big impact early now that I think it's becoming this position that's rightfully so more valued early in the draft. And And obviously, we know that as the draft gets closer, these quarterbacks, they only go one way on the board usually, and it's up. So there's a good chance, I think, that the Jets can get that offensive line piece that they need. And they also have a level of flexibility there because they can keep Elijah Vera Tucker at guard or kick him out to tackle. And that gives them flexibility to maybe solve their problem in free agency cheaper by getting a guard who's of starting caliber, which obviously is less costly than signing a tackle, which would help them with their cap space situation and then address the tackle situation in the draft. I think that would be the ideal situation for the Jets, and that's the only way you can justify not trading down.
Good point. And then obviously they have to protect an aging coming off a torn Achilles, Aaron Rodgers. The Fuaga pick is framed here by Daniel Jeremiah says calls him a plug and play right tackle. Okay, so is that so? How do you view that? Would you put Fuaga as your left tackle and Vera Tucker at right? Because Vera Tucker's been he's played on the right side, he's played right tackle. Or do you put Fuaga right and then Vera Tucker left? This is all presuming Becton's gone. What's the plan? Say they draft Fuaga. What's your plan then at both tackle spots? Where does Fuaga play and who plays the other one?
I haven't done the research in terms of like where Fuaga's record on versatility, but we know Vera Tucker can play at both sides because he's played every position but center in his career, and he's played all of them at a high level. So I mean, I think you put whoever you draft where they're most comfortable, because if you're drafting a tackle in the top 10, like, and it's a guy who's a left tackle, you believe he can be your left tackle of the future.
Sure.
So if it's that situation, you put Vera Tucker at right tackle, and now you've got, hopefully the Vera Tucker injury thing is now becoming an issue. Both of them are kind of freak injuries, but it's happened 2 years in a row now. If it happens again, it's you can't count on them. I think we're still before that point, but and the Jets have to assume a level of risk because they have too many holes to fill not to be able to assume some risks. So I think that's a smart risk to take, that you bank on a guy like Elijah Vera Tucker. And I think that's the way you kind of attack this thing. He does give them that flexibility, though. So if they don't have what they want there and they trade down to the middle of the first round and get a guard there, if you're drafting a guard in the middle of the first round, you're going to expect him to be your guard of the future as well. So they have the flexibility to get this done, but a lot has to go right.
You mentioned flexibility as it pertains not only to what you were just referring to, but also you just previously mentioned Vera Tucker's flexibility, the ability to play either tackle spot. And as you were talking, I quickly looked up something Daniel Jeremiah said about Talese Fuaga. And the quote is there, he said, there is no limitation. I guess he meant there are, if we're going to be a nitpicky, there are no limitations on Fuaga playing either tackle position. So Daniel Jeremiah thinks that this kid can play either tackle spot. And as you said, Elijah Vera Tucker potentially could play either tackle spot. So that is another certainly example of flexibility, which
In that
it
case, you put Vera Tucker at left because it's a more important position. He's more established. He's obviously proven he can do it at that level.
okay, gives him some
That's what I would
options,
say.
which all good and ideal, but as we know, from the Jets injury luck with Vera Tucker and with Becton, ideal is not always something you could bank on. When you have a, you know, when you have, and you could not necessarily bank on a pick working out. So for whatever reasons, injuries or whatever. So, as we've seen, the Jets and the Giants have not always gotten the ideal situations out of their draft picks recently. But yeah, so we'll leave it with that. Appreciate everybody listening. And be sure to like, rate, review, subscribe to us on all your favorite podcasting platforms. And as usual, nj.com/Jets, nj.com/Giants for all sorts of coverage leading up to free agency, the draft, the combine. Andy will be there. I'll be covering it from home. He'll be lending a hand with some Giants stuff, and I really appreciate that him doing that. And so, yeah, we'll leave it there, and we will be back with you. Not quite that we did about a month and 11 days since our last one. It won't be that big of a gap. Probably almost about a month from now because we're both flying out. At least I'm flying out on Saturday, March the 23rd to Orlando for the owners' meetings, where not only pretty much, I think, is the case, I think, for the Jets and Giants and almost all teams. The owner will talk, the GM and the coach. Definitely the GM and the coach, and almost and the owner usually too. So you get all three of the big guns there in Orlando for the, I guess, the NFL annual meeting, as it's called. That runs from essentially the 24th, Sunday, the 24th of March through the 27th, that Wednesday. And so leading up to that, leading up to the, the March 23 departure, we'll do another one of these. So less than a month. And at that point, we'll have a better idea of what these teams have done in free agency and where things stand for the draft and how these rosters will take shape entering what will be a hot seat year, as we mentioned, for both Robert Saleh and Brian Daboll. So appreciate everybody listening, and we will be back with you at that point. And everyone have a good day and good week, and I guess good month until we talk to you again. Take care.